This is Tape 2, Side B, of Jeff Salzman's How to Get Results with People.
What we're looking for, and this is important, what we're looking for in any of these areas is excellence, not perfection. Okay? We don't get too bound up when we fail at something here, or when we fall short. Going for excellence, not perfection. Where a lot of us fall short in this leadership business is that it's more important to us to be liked. And we're afraid of making unpopular decisions. We're afraid of giving ourselves permission to make an unpopular decision that's going to affect somebody's life. But what we're after in leadership is not necessarily to be liked, but to be respected. And there's a difference there. There's a difference there. And to be respected, you have to be willing to be disliked from time to time. It's difficult to do the first couple times if you haven't been somebody who's been willing to let that happen. But once you do it, people get onto it. And people, believe me, are much happier working for people they respect than for people they like. Okay? Take that as a leap of faith if you don't believe it. Act as if that's true, and you have far better results. Yeah. Explain the difference between going after perfection and excellence. There's a lot to say on that subject. A lot of times people are sufficiently insecure about their own skills and talents. It's a lot of that fear of success stuff where you think, well, gee, here I am. My God, I'm standing in front of 300 business people. I mean, don't they know I'm just Jeff from Edinburgh, Pennsylvania? I mean, God. And we're afraid of being found out, right? And so what we want to do is be perfect at everything so nobody can ever point out any flaws. And it's kind of neurotic behavior. But a lot of people have at least a touch of that kind of neurosis, where they're just not willing to make any mistakes. And so what happens with that is that you're afraid to take any action. People who are perfectionists are constantly bogged down. You have to rip projects out of their hands because it can always be done a little better and it's not right, and boy, if I had more time. And they're afraid of taking any action because, let's face it, any new action requires the risk of failure. And perfectionists are unwilling to fail, therefore they're unwilling to act. Now, people who strive for excellence, on the other hand, understand that mistakes and failures is kind of like a box of Cracker Jacks. There's always a prize there. There's always an upside. You can always learn. And with every mistake, sometimes life is not real clear, but in this case, it always works this way. With every mistake, there comes a lesson. It's that simple. And so people who strive for excellence accept their mistakes, learn the lesson, and move on. And they become a couple percent better in that area. And that's the difference. It's a good way, it's good to institutionalize these kind of abstractions. I hate to leave anything be abstract because you then file it away and say, gee, that's interesting, and you don't do anything about it. Then I'm the same way. I mean, that's how human beings are. So here's how you can institutionalize excellence instead of perfectionism. A career track, and I know a lot of other companies do this too. We have a sheet. It's actually a form that people are given when they're hired at Career Track. And on the top of it is printed in type. It says, mistake I'll never make again. Okay? And then there's 3 points. And you fill this out when you make a mistake. 1, what the mistake was. 2, what I did to minimize the damage. And 3, what I did so that it will never happen again. Okay? And that works real well. Everybody in our company fills one of those out when they make a mistake. I do it too. We put it in our file, and when we have a review, we bring it, and we proudly show, this is a mistake I'll never make again. And every now and then we look at it to remind ourselves how much smarter we are than we used to be. Okay? So it's a good way of institutionalizing learning from your mistakes, because it's such a drag and such a waste of time to make the same mistake over and over again. I mean, it's just a waste of time. Okay, anyone else before we move on? Yes. He says that he agrees that a leader should understand or should keep the eye on the results, but shouldn't he understand the process as well? Yes. A basic working knowledge is pretty much all that's required. It's just like, look at George Shultz. Before he was Secretary of State, he was president of Bechtel, a multinational construction company. Before he was president of Bechtel, he was Secretary of the Treasury. Three very different areas of technical expertise: economics, construction, diplomacy. The thing is, George Shultz is just a darn good manager. Now, obviously, he's a quick study, but he's managing experts who know 1,000 times more about many different areas than he does, and he still manages them successfully. There's a concept in the business world called zero defects. Quality is free, anyway, is the name of the book. If you're interested in quality control, it's an excellent book. And what they put forth is the idea of zero defects. And what it says is this. It says, how many newborn infants is it okay for the nurse to drop? Right? None. Zero. How many times is it okay for you to drive home from work and pull into the wrong driveway and go into the wrong house? Zero. And the point being that for routine, repetitive tasks, zero defects is the only thing that's acceptable. Okay? When you're pushing the limit, however, when you're on the frontier, as leaders need to be, I mean, people frankly die in pushing the frontiers of medicine. That happens. And we don't like it, but if we weren't willing to let it happen, we wouldn't get anywhere. So it's the difference between a routine task and a pushing the envelope, if you will, task. Okay, let's move on. That's an excellent discussion. I love those because they go everywhere. All right, next point is the exercise of power. Again, we move back to that. There are really two directions in which you can exercise power in your organization. These are often referred to as the X direction and the Y direction. And I know this is going to be old hat for some of you because it's Management 101, but I'm going to go over it briefly because it's real important for those of you who haven't heard it. Basically, the difference between an X management style and a Y management style is the difference between, as we talked about, the bully boss and the more democratic boss, is that X managers tend to manage by punishing bad behavior. Y managers tend to manage by rewarding good behavior. And both of these different approaches to using power work. They both get different results, but they do get results. Now, let me give you the difference. The X and Y management principles were developed by McGregor, but before that, really the basis for all of this kind of stuff was developed in the 1930s at Harvard by a man named B.F. Skinner, who most of you have probably heard of and know what he did. But briefly again, what B.F. Skinner did was he put pigeons in what he humbly called a Skinner box. Okay? And in this Skinner box, he had a little lever. And whenever the pigeon would happen to peck the lever, food would come down a chute. And the pigeon, being very smart, soon came to associate pecking the lever with getting food, and it would peck the lever whenever it was hungry. Now, B.F. Skinner also had another kind of box, and in this box, he had an electrically charged wire. Now, in this box, whenever the pigeon would happen to peck the electrically charged wire, it would be electrocuted and would stop. Wait a minute, no. It would get an electric shock and would stop. Electrocution probably would have stopped the little bugger too. But anyway, it would get an electric shock and it would stop. Now, that, folks, is as elegant an explanation as I can give you for the difference in the results with people you get with X and Y management. X management, punishing bad behavior, gets people to stop doing things, stop pecking the wire. Y management, rewarding good behavior, gets people to do things, to peck the lever. And that's the result you get. Now, that's not to say that X management isn't sometimes appropriate. Sometimes we need simply to get people to stop doing something. Or we need to order people to do something now because it's an emergency situation. If this room should suddenly burst into flames, I'm not going to say, well, let's break up into small groups and discuss what we can do about this, am I? No, I'm going to say, there's the door, everybody after me, right? Right. So sometimes it's appropriate, but for the most part, why management, rewarding good behavior, is what motivates people. And it's simply because people have changed. People have changed. We have a new mentality in the workforce today. It's just like we ask, what gets results with you? No, not one person said money. Although, I'm sure money does get results with you too. But what we're after is a higher set of needs. And let's look at it a minute. If you look at the history of employment, here's pretty much how it breaks down. Back in the old days, when you wanted somebody to work for you, you went, you clubbed them over the head, you pillaged their village, you dragged them back to your village, and you worked them to death. Okay? Then you probably ate them. Okay? It's the truth. That's probably the longest chapter of employment history we have. I mean, coercive employment. That was right up in the United States until about 120 years ago with the slaves. It's not that long ago. Some of our great-grandparents can remember it. Okay? Then we had another phase. We had the immigrant phase. We had people coming to this new land who were basically not making it where they were. I know we deify our forefathers, and rightly so, but let's face it. These people were at the bottom of the barrel. They were the religious nuts, at least from the perspective of the society they were in. And they were coming here simply because they needed a place where they could support their family, where they could eat, where they could have a roof over their head. And they were willing to do any kind of dehumanizing work they had to in order to get that money. Okay? Now, we have a whole different set of needs. Any of you who are familiar with Maslow's hierarchy, what we're doing is just moving up. And now, our biggest problem with food is we eat too much of it. Ever notice? I mean, we have a whole different problem now. And so now, what we come to work for is something entirely different. We come to work to be part of a team, to be part of something bigger than ourselves, to be committed to something, to make a contribution to the world. And that's why opening doors, rewarding good behavior, because people want to contribute. That's what they're there for now. And just opening doors and giving them the opportunity to generally works best. So, let's boil that, bring that all down to earth a little bit here, and look at some of the specific techniques that we can use in our businesses, particularly when in the leadership side, where we're managing and supervising people, how we can get the kind of results we want. Under the applied principles and techniques, you'll see the first statement is a statement that comes from a new book called The Greatest Management Principle in the World. And it's an interesting book, and obviously it makes a pretty big promise, wouldn't you say? I'm going to save you the trouble of having to buy and read this book, because I'm now going to give you the greatest management principle in the world. And this is it. Ready? The things that get rewarded are the things that get done. The things that get rewarded are the things that get done. Now, again, something that's fairly easy in principle, but difficult in practice. Because, first of all, a lot of you are not free to give rewards. You're working in a bureaucracy. You're working for somebody who ties your hands. You're not free to give rewards. Or are you? Now, there was a study done. It's a classic study done by Kenneth Kovac at the University of Maryland, where he and his researchers ask a cross-section of business managers to rate 10 motivators. Motivators being money, time off, interesting work, tactful discipline. 10 motivators in order that they felt these 10 motivators motivated their people. Then the researchers asked workers to rate the same 10 motivators according to how well they motivated them. Okay, you understand? The managers rated them according to how well they motivated their workers. The workers rated them according to how well they motivated them. Now, what do you think the manager said was the number one motivator? Money, right, of course. Number two, promotions. Number three, time off. Okay? All expensive things, all on the content level. What do you think the workers said? Right. Number one, appreciation. Number two, interesting work. Number three, get this, sympathy for personal problems. The feeling of being treated like something other than a cog in the machine. Now notice that the managers were delivering motivators entirely on the content level, and workers were asking for motivators entirely on the ego level. And that's not to say that that's how it always works, and that's certainly not to say that money isn't a motivator. It was, incidentally, number four from the workers. All right? So money is important. But what's more important is the feeling of being part of something. So when we talk about rewards, sure, it can be money. Sure, it can be promotions. It can be time off. But you know what else it can be? It can be a more challenging assignment. It can be a higher title. It can be the preferred parking space. It can be a gold star. It can be employee of the week. And a lot of those things are difficult to pull off, again, because they're not real. Managers sometimes do these things, and they don't really understand it, and they don't really mean it. And so it becomes demotivating for people. For instance, if you were to give somebody employee of the week in your company just for doing a good job, that would be demotivating to the other nine people who are also doing a good job. When you pick somebody out of the crowd, as we do a career track, we have career trackers of the week. We pick people out and we say, career tracker of the week is so-and-so because they did this, that, or the other thing. It's a specific going beyond the call of duty. For instance, John is waiter of the week at this restaurant because when Mrs. McGillicuddy came in and she threw a temper tantrum because her table wasn't ready, he calmed her down, gave her a complimentary dessert, and got a $20 tip. Okay, that's superstar behavior. And when you put down what they did, it's very motivating. Also, a side benefit of this is that you're holding up constantly role models. This is what's excellent around here. This is what we reward around here. This is the behaviors we want. Another thing, don't make it be one employee of the week. Life doesn't happen that way. A career track, sometimes we'll have seven career trackers of the week. Sometimes we won't have any. And it's more real that way. If there's one career tracker of the week, that, again, it's that much more artificial. The more real you can make it, the better. Now, a career track, we give employees a very distinctive flower arrangement. It's been the same flower arrangement in a pink vase from day one. And so whoever has it on their desk is very proud of it. And we have their name on the marquee, and that's it. We used to give a dinner for two. That was motivating too. That was on the content level. You can do that. Preferred parking space. It doesn't have to, again, be on the content level. The things that get rewarded are the things that get done. Another thing, how many of you have ever read the book, The 1 Minute Manager? The 1 Minute Manager, very simple book, easy to read, basically dealt with three principles, the 1 Minute goal setting, the 1 Minute reprimand, and the 1 Minute praising. All right? Do you remember how they described the 1 Minute praising? They said, catch people in the act of what? Doing something right. What a novel idea. Again, about 180 degrees opposite of how we normally manage or conventional management. I can remember my first boss. He said this. He says, you know, if you don't hear from me, you're doing all right. Isn't, boy, boss, that makes me want to go out and really, you know, tear it down the highway, you know. Very motivating. Catching people in the act of doing something right doesn't have to be terribly dramatic. It's simply the idea of walking around, looking at what somebody's doing, talking to them, saying, gee, I'm glad you're getting to that. That looks great. Little touch, reinforces the message, and you move on. That's it. Now, the problem that a lot of us have with that kind of praising is that we don't want to be unfair. I don't want to catch John doing something right now and not catch him doing something right later. And I don't want to catch John and not catch Mary or Julie or Lisa. And so we get bound up about being fair about it. And the thing is, don't worry about being fair about it. You can't be fair about it. And in fact, it's been shown that inconsistent rewards are far more motivating than consistent rewards. B.F. Skinner found that out back in the 30s. He found out that if he gave his pigeons food every time they pecked the lever when they were hungry. If he gave them food every 10th or 22nd or 7th or 16th, some unpredictable interval that they pressed the lever all day long. He had them pressing the lever up to 10,000 times in one day. Okay? Now, that's not to say that people are pigeons, necessarily. Okay? But there are some who were all alive, after all. Okay. Rewarding. Next point is initiative. Again, that word pops up. Because in order to create, as a leader, the star employee, the star contributor, we want people who are also taking initiative. In fact, in our little pockets of excellence that we create around us, no matter how badly our company is run, in our little pocket of excellence, we want a goal-driven initiating team. I don't care if it's three people. And so we want people to take initiative. How do you do that? How do you get people to take initiative? Well, one is, and it's again, it's sort of an attitude adjustment, but that is, understand that most people that are working for you, or most people that you're trying to lead, whether it's your children or friends or whatever, have been raised in the same kind of school system, where initiative, for the most part, has not been rewarded. So a lot of times, it's as simple as just telling them that it's expected of them to take initiative. I can remember that hit me like a bolt from the blue. In my first job, I was probably 15 years old. I started working at Tasty Freeze, which is a little soft ice cream stand in Parkstown Corners, Pennsylvania. And my manager's name was Emma. And Emma had been there a good 100 years. I mean, Emma knew Tasty Freeze inside and out. And Emma had a saying, and her saying was this. She said, "There's always something to do at Tasty Freeze." Now, what she meant was, it's not okay to stand around. There's always counters to be wiped off. There's always inventory to stack. There's always mix to be mixed. And if you can't think of anything to do, see me, Emma, and I'll give you something. Now, you soon learned to find something on your own to do, because you didn't like what Emma gave you to do. All right? That, as I said, hit me like a bolt from the blue. I had no idea that I was empowered to do that. So that's a good one. Another way to get people to take initiative is to delegate work in terms of the result, not the process. Again, that principle crops up. In terms of the result, not the process. Say that you have a pizza shop, and you're hiring a high school kid to come in and clean after school. All right, now a couple ways you can approach this. One way is that you can approach this kid this way. You could say, "Okay, George, here you are. First day on the job, welcome. Here's what you do. First, you wipe off the tables. Then you sweep up the floor. Then you polish the brass railing in front of the counter. Then you wipe off the glass to the door to the sidewalk of the fingerprints, and you go through, and you're a good manager. You tell him everything he has to do. You have a little checklist, maybe. You do it with him. You let him do it by himself. You critique it. You're doing everything right in training. And if you have somebody with a good work ethic, you'll have a good, competent job. That's how it works for the most part. Now, let's look at another way you can approach George. Another way you can approach George is you can say, "Okay, George, here you are, first day in the job. Here's what you do. I want this to be the cleanest, most sparkling pizza shop I want this place to shine. I want this place to be an oasis from the storm, however you want to do it. And that's your job, is to make this place shine. And what you do to do that is you wipe off the tables, you sweep the floor. Of course, you can go through and train and do all of the process, because it's important in some cases. And everything you tell this person to do, you do in the context of, I want this place to shine. And if you've done that, if you've delegated the result, not the process, then you'll have somebody who sees that there's crumbs under the oven. And this place isn't sparkling if there's crumbs under the oven. And you might have somebody who sees that the front of the ovens have crud all over them. They need to be scoured with a steel wool pad. This place isn't sparkling if there's crud in the oven. And you might have somebody who sees that during the dinner hour, during the rush hour, he has to wipe off that door 4 or 5 times because people keep putting their fingerprints on it. And you'll have somebody who's initiating all over the place because he owns the result. He owns the job. People don't take pride in sweeping. People take pride in clean. Okay? Don't deprive them of it. Think of how you can do that. Again, it's connecting people to the whole, letting them see how what they do contributes. Nobody wants to be a cog in the machine. So another way of developing initiative. A third way is, as we talked about before, the mistakes. Let people know it's okay to make a mistake once. Okay? That's not to mean that you sanction incompetence. And that's not to mean that you accept somebody who is mistake prone and makes the same mistake over and over again. In some cases, when you have somebody like that, it's a good idea. I'm talking about the jinx. You know those people? I mean, there's a word for them from ancient Egypt. These are people who seem to have a need to make mistakes. That's how they get their jollies or their attention in the world. I don't know. But when you run into a person like that, it's a good idea to consider freeing up their future. Okay? Do them a favor. Next point is creating the star employee or the star contributor who solves his or her own problems. Sometimes that's a little difficult for us as managers because there's a certain reassurance that comes when people keep running into our office and saying, what do I do now? What do I do now? Because at least we know that we're not dispensable, right? But it's a bad way to spend your time when you're trying to be empowering other people. And so here's how you do it. There's a principle that's probably one of the single best principles I've ever run into in business. It's another way to institutionalize a process that can really work for you. It's a principle called completed staff work. It's a military principle that was presumably developed by Napoleon. And here's how it works. When you worked for Napoleon, you didn't go to Napoleon and say, Napoleon, we have a problem. The supply lines are cut off. 10,000 men are starving. What are we going to do? When you worked for Napoleon, you went to Napoleon and you said this. You said, Napoleon, we have a problem. The supply lines are cut off. 10,000 men are starving. And here's what we can do. We can do A, we can do B, and we can do C. Completed staff work is simply the process of requiring your people to come to you not only with problems, but with options and a recommendation. Not just a problem, but options and a recommendation, and it is magical. What will happen for you? First of all, first benefit seems like a silly one, but it's not. First of all, completed staff work slows those people down who are just invested in problems. Do you know people like that? They like problems. They like upsetting you. It's the most fun they've had all day. They've been sitting in front of a computer. It's fun. If you require those people to come to you not only with a problem, but with options and a recommendation, it's sometimes too much work. Better just to deal with it. Another thing that completed staff work does for you, and this is probably the best And that is, it gives you more options. Let's face it. People who are coming to you with problems, they're on the front lines. You probably haven't been doing their job for quite some time. They'll think of things that you may not think of. And you'll have more options to choose from, which puts you in a better position. Another thing that completed staff work will do for you is that it will create what's often referred to in education as a teaching moment. And a teaching moment is that moment when somebody is never more open to your wisdom. And that they're never more open to your wisdom than they are when they're in the middle of a problem. It's just like, here's an example of a teaching moment. A teaching moment is when your 9 or 10 year old child comes up to you and says, "Mom, Dad, how are babies made?" Okay, that's a teaching moment. When that happens, you drop whatever you're doing and you turn your attention to somebody who needs to learn something they need to know. And that's true in management as well. When they're in the thick of the problem, they're open. Now, another way you can use completed staff work is that you can use it yourself. Require yourself to go to your boss, not only with problems, but with options and a recommendation. And one of two things will happen. First, you'll be right. And that's great. That's a feather in your cap. If you're right enough times, you can go to your boss and say, "You know, boss, I've been right the last 5 out of 5 times on issues like this. I wonder if I need to keep coming to you with them." And you may have created a little bit more of a range of authority for yourself. Okay? The other thing that can happen is that you'll be wrong. And you can go to your boss and say, "Okay, boss, obviously I'm missing something. What do you know that I don't? Where did my judgment go askew?" And you can create a teaching moment for yourself. I do these seminars all over, and one thing I hear consistently is, "My boss doesn't talk to me. My boss doesn't give me any guidance. I don't know what I'm supposed to be doing." And that's a chronic problem in business, and rightly so. It makes sense. Most people are not trained professors, but yet they have to teach. And if you create teaching moments for yourself, you'll force your boss. It's called managing your boss. Did you ever hear of this? Yeah, you'll force your boss to give you some of the benefit of their knowledge. Okay, so completed staff work. And then the last point in creating the star contributor is ask questions and listen to answers. Ask questions and listen to answers. Now, this is another simple one, but it's difficult sometimes to do. Look at it this way. When you're the leader of your team, you play a lot of roles. First of all, when you're the leader of your team, you're the coach. You determine who plays what position and what the plays will be. When you're the leader of your team, you're also the referee. You determine what the rules are, who broke them, what the penalties will be. When you're the leader of your team, you're also the cheerleaders. You cheer people on to greater victories. You provide the support, the emotional support, the enthusiasm. And when you're the leader of your team, you're probably also a player. And that's a difficult role, because what happens is most people become leaders of their team because they were darn good players. Isn't that right? Most people get promoted because they were very good in their position. It's just like, it's a classic problem of the top salesperson becoming sales manager and failing, because it requires a whole different set of skills.
This finishes tape 2. Please remove this cassette and go on to tape 3, side A, for some ideas on leadership, management, and MBWA.